This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for joining me. This is Greg Soden, and I'm here with another great book conversation. On this episode, I welcome Danielle Dulski. Danielle Dulski is an Aquarian mischief maker, painter, and word witch who is the author of several books, including The Holy Wild, The Holy Wild Grimoire, Woman Most Wild, and several more. On this episode, Danielle and I discuss her brand new book, Bones and Honey, A Heathen Prayer Book, out now from New World Library. This book is a witch's devotional, a collection of nature-inspired prayers, incantations, stories, and pagan poetry. This is my third conversation with Danielle since 2018, and it is absolutely wonderful to reconnect and chat about Bones and Honey. You can find her website at danielledulski.com. Enjoy. Danielle Dulski, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me back, Greg.
I am delighted that you're here, Danielle. I love our conversations that we've been having on various podcasts over the last several years. For listeners out there who don't know who you are or maybe haven't heard any of our previous conversations, can you go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit to the audience so they know who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Danielle Dulski. I am an author, a painter, a word witch, and a mother of two wild sons soon to flee the nest.
Amazing.
So that's where my heart is right now.
Fabulous. Well, you and I have collaborated and had some wonderful conversations in the past. The first time we ever came across each other was to talk about your book, The Holy Wild, which I put out in October 2018. And then Seasons of Moon and Flame, which we talked about in May of 2020, which was a very strange moment in human history. And I loved that conversation as well because we talked about the strangeness of that time. But I'm pleased to welcome you back for your new book, Bones and Honey, A Heathen Prayer Book, released November 7th, 2023 from our friends at New World Library. Can you go ahead and catch me up a little bit on what your life has been like since you were last here nearly 4 years ago, if you can believe it?
I can't believe it. Yeah, I was thinking about the last time I spoke with you. It was sort of, in the very beginning chapter of the global underworld story. And now we're maybe, I don't know, still in the beginning, I think, but not the first chapter anyway. We're a few chapters in. And I really feel like the changes that's been going on in the global collective, or the way I'm receiving them anyway, have been mirrored in my personal life, because I have gone through quite a few changes in the past few years. And I think that my books have kind of reflected that. So since Seasons of Moon and Flame in 2020, there have been, I did an Oracle deck, and then I did The Holy Wild Grimoire, was a book I wrote in 2022. And then Bones and Honey just came out this fall. And I think you can almost track like how I've been becoming kind of a beast or a monster from my writing in those books. So we're in the middle of seeing our oldest son go off to college this summer, and then we're going to be leaving where we've lived for quite a long time, my husband and I, moving to the wilds, a very rural area where the internet and other things are quite questionable.
Yeah.
Other resources that I'm very used to are questionable. And so I've sort of been knowing that that was going to happen and preparing for that big transition, at least for the past 2 years, and just, yeah, readying myself to really live a much more, I think, simple life. And also kind of terrified and not really sure what that's going to look like, because I've never really done simple very well. So we'll see.
Wonderful. Well, I know that we missed talking about the Holy Wild Grimoire, a heathen handbook of magic spells and verses. What was that process like, moving from the Holy Wild Grimoire into Bones and Honey? Kind of tell me what your mindset was like with moving into this new book. Tell me about the origin of Bones and Honey, if you will, from that time period.
Yeah, so Bones and Honey is a heathen prayer book. So it's written very differently from all of my other books, and it's in that it doesn't have a lot of spells or rituals in it, Bones and Honey. It's really just about these 13 archetypes that I was looking at as being very medicinal for the world story. So thinking about, you know, where the world or where an individual might be wounded, there's an archetypal medicine that can come through, but it usually comes through art. And so we look at the medicine that the world needs and the doors that artists start to open, even in very small ways, like my heathen prayer book. I look as like I'm just kind of cracking the door open a little bit for the medicine of these 13 archetypes to come through. But so once I named those archetypes, then I was able to write the book pretty quickly, because it just seemed like, well, it always seems like there's kind of an otherworldly intelligence that comes through me when I'm writing in a certain way. But that way was able to be amplified in just writing these prayers in Bones and Honey. Like I think about my previous books, you know, they're more traditional nonfiction. So I'm having to kind of step, I call it like a kind of spiraling out, where I have to really assess and make sure what I'm saying makes sense. Sure I'm using, you know, the proper grammar and all of that. You're having to do that a lot in a traditional nonfiction book, but in a book of prayer or poetry, you don't have to do that quite as much. And yet it's kind of like every paragraph really has to be on it, because every paragraph is a prayer. So it was really allowing what I would call my muse to come through in a much more pure and loud way all the way through that book. So I was able to write it surprisingly quickly compared to my other books, where I'm having to, you know, check my references and do all of those things that we do.
Sure. Like, do you, when you're writing in this style, where you're kind of like channeling this energy, do you feel as if you kind of like go to a different place, so to speak? Because I've heard about writers talking about the zones that they get into whenever something is just flowing through them. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I'm super curious about that, how that feels in the moment.
Yeah, it's something I think about a lot. I don't really feel like I go to another place. It does feel a bit like a conversation, because I can really still sense that, you know, academic writer Danielle is there, because she's the one that's having to put the period in the right place and make sure the sentence is structured in the right way. But then there is this kind of dance between her voice and this other voice that certainly doesn't care about grammar or punctuation. And it's really coming through in terms of the language. So when I'm in that zone, I tend to see what I'm about to write first. So I see it, and then I'm kind of describing it. So that thing that I see, that's what feels like it's coming from something beyond me, what I would call the wild unseen. And I don't really know where that comes from. I mean, I certainly don't necessarily credit it to any single deity or anything. It just seems like it's there, and it's deep, and it's kind of outside of time. Feels like a timeless vision most of the time. And then, you know, I'm just describing it in the best way I can. And sometimes when you write that way, because I've spoken with other writers who write that way, and they tend to be clairvoyant, they tend to identify as clairvoyant. So be able to see either prophetic visions, things before they happen, or psychically, they can kind of see what's going on with a person if they're standing in front of them. Even though it's not necessarily blatant in the material realm, they can see it. So writers that write in that clairvoyant way, they aren't really, they usually don't feel like they're completely there when they're writing, but they're also not there. And you get this proof that that's true, because you'll all of a sudden be typing a word that you just, like, either you haven't used it in 20 years or you've never thought about it before. It's kind of like when you have that weird initiatory experience in a dream where it just gives you proof that dreams are magical, because it's like, I have never seen that thing before, and yet it was there in my dream.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. So the subtitle of the book catches my eye too, as a person who talks about different concepts and different traditions and different, you know, things that people do all around the world. The word heathen stands out to me, the subtitle, A Heathen's Prayer Book. And I'm wondering if you can just say for listeners out there who might be curious about the concept, like, what is heathenism like to you, in your view, Danielle?
Yeah, so the word heathen, so I'm a huge word nerd, as you might be also.
yeah, go for it. I love it.
So the word heathen means dweller on the heath. And so heathens were the last, primarily in the Celtic lands, to be colonized or Christianized. So that word heathen, it really just kind of means like the rural people, just like the word pagan means that, you know, the dweller in the country. So when I think about what the word heathen means to me, I do have this little ache in my body, because my mother used to call me a little heathen when I like didn't want to go to church or when I was talking during church or doing all of those other very sinful things that a five-year-old shouldn't do. I was a little heathen, so I was looking at it like it was a bad thing. But then, of course, getting older and feeling very kind of seduced by witchcraft and the things that were forbidden as a child, you know, the word heathen became much more interesting than it was when I was a child and just being called it like it was something derogatory. So heathen to me now is all about constantly, I mean, almost daily, asking myself, what does it really mean to live on untamed ground? You know, my father was a great outlaw in that he died in 2007. So I can say this now, he did a lot of things that were like illegal. And he got away with them. And he always taught me that you kind of figure out how much you can get away with. I mean, how much you want to do and how much you can get away with, and then do that, like go to that edge where it's like, this is how much I can get away with. So do that, but don't get caught. And to me, there's something about the word heathen and that it's like, you know, we just like in the old fairy tales, the witch lives on the fringes. She doesn't live totally removed from society, but she's not at the center of it either. She's just on the edges where she can kind of see what's going on and kind of witch things from the inside. And I feel like that's what the heathen does also. They're just, you know, the dweller on the heath. They're not completely isolated. They're not completely removed, but they're not at the center either. They're in that place where they can kind of have the long vision and see the, you know, more than just what's right in front of them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, well, we're talking in the morning right now, and interestingly to me, Bones and Honey opens with like a reference to the importance of how people start their days, which I really enjoyed. You refer to the early mornings as our time of ageless wandering, which I really loved that description. I'm wondering, like, just generally, like, how do you start your days? Like, what's your routine like, you know, with your, like, views on the world and like the writing that you do? Tell me a little bit about how you start that ageless wandering moments in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, well, I am a huge word nerd and I'm a huge dream nerd. So I do really tend to my dreams before I even get out of bed, and then in the moments after. So if my children are here and they haven't gone to school yet, they know that the first thing mom asks them in the morning is, what did they dream about? And then, did they write it down? And I'm lucky because my older son now is in a psychology course where his assignment for the entire year was to track his dreams. So I have like a backup from his teacher. But you know, I think it's Dr. Estes says we all wake up as children. So there is that few minutes where you're kind of still in that alpha state when you wake up, unless you wake up with an alarm, which I'm lucky that I don't usually have to do that. I mean, sometimes I do, but usually I don't. And I can be in that place where I'm just remembering what I dreamt about and really trying to hold on to it and not trying to figure out what it means yet, because it won't mean the same thing to me in that weird upon waking state as it will once I'm coffeeed and moving around. And so so there's kind of a divide. And I also do this practice before I get out of bed where I ask the mystery to show me three objects that I will encounter at some point during my day. And so I'll see these three strange things, and they are usually strange and they don't usually make sense. But then as the day goes on, I do usually encounter at least one of them. And usually that happens within 3 hours after waking up, and I'll be like, oh, that was that thing. So that's an important practice. And then in terms of my very disciplined witchcraft after everybody leaves and my house is empty, because I'm also lucky that I do usually have that in the morning, I'll go to my altar and I'll light my candles and I'll sort of set my intention for the day and make offerings to my ancestors. And all of that, even though it sounds elaborate, takes just a few minutes, and then after that I'm ready.
Excellent. Well, amazing. You mentioned earlier the 13 archetype layout in Bones and Honey. I love this ambitiousness. I love this layout. And I'm wondering if you could just kind of talk about generally the organization of the book, of what readers can expect when they kind of start diving into this thing.
Yeah. So each chapter in Bones and Honey is dedicated to a particular archetype that, like I said, I was kind of feeling like these are all medicinal archetypes. I on purpose didn't really go into the shadow side of these archetypes, even though each of those archetypes would have a shadow side, you know, a kind of more twisted version of that archetype. For instance, the pagan warrioress. I mean, we of course don't want to be at war all the time or engaging in our personal battles all the time. And yet that warrioress archetype can be medicinal when it's about training and preparation and sort of gathering the tools that you need for a spiritual initiation, for example. So each of the 13 chapters, they're called the book of the pagan warrioress or the book of the wounded healer. And then within each book, there are 13 different prayers. And most of those are just 1 to 3 paragraph prayers. And prayer means earnest request. So these aren't necessarily petitions to a deity, they can be prayers to your future self or to your ancestors or descendants. So those prayers are very like petitions or charms in witchcraft, where they are traveling somewhere, but you're kind of deciding what that destination is. So my hope was that that would alleviate any tensions around the word prayer and thinking that it was needed to be to the God of our childhood or something. And some of those prayers are also fairy tales. So retellings of mostly familiar, some not, but mostly familiar fairy tales, and those stories amplifying those archetypes also.
Okay, cool. So something that you and I have chatted about in the past is the strangeness of the world. A lot of the strangeness has become a lot more visible post 2020, but there was always a lot of strangeness there if you let yourself stop and think about it a lot. But You write in this book, there's a quote I love, says, "Dire times are marked by the guilt of the visionaries." Love that quote. The book often refers throughout to like climate collapse, war, pandemic. Tell me what you were paying most careful attention to, like with regards to the world while writing Bones and Honey. What had your attention?
Oh, that's a good question. So I wrote most of it around this time last year. So around this time in, so around January and February of 2023. And I always refer to those months, but especially January, as being my kind of witch's dark night of the soul, because that's the month that my birthday is housed in. Mm-hmm. And so I'm needing to kind of manage this, I call it my weeping snow hag archetype. Mm. And when I do that, I am a pretty prolific writer. I don't know how great I am in other areas of my life, but I am able to write really well. And so I think that I was probably paying attention to AI and the, you know, the rise of the robots and the tension between art. And I was especially feeling the potential for, or the kind of ache that I had around young writers and where I was in my 20s and even before that, you know, writing these things that really were objectively bad. Like they weren't really good pieces of writing. And yet I kept going. There was something in me that made me kept going. And I was thinking about how, you know, nowadays, but of course in the coming years, a young poet or a young writer would be able to put, you know, a few topics into an AI program and be able to have like this story or this poem or this song generated. And it maybe would be objectively better than anything that they could write at that time. And how terrible that, like a real tragedy that is. I remember I was just talking to all of my friends about that and really feeling that ache. And we were saying, you know, if we're going to make whatever our great work is, we're going to do our great art, we have to do it now. Yeah. Because if we don't, you know, some artificial program might do it for us. And of course not as well, but they would do it for us. So the time is now. I was really feeling that sense of urgency in winter and spring of last year for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, thinking about like, you know, darkness and times of year, something else that stands out to me in the book is the concept of grief. And I really, this is something that I personally struggle with. Like I've had some losses in the past several years that I'm still kind of working my way through. So whenever something involving grief comes up in books or stories or movies that I'm consuming at the time, it kind of grabs my attention. And you had a chapter called The Book of the Bone Witch, which does explicitly deal with grief. And you know, just knowing that I've had like these like losses that I'm personally dealing with, knowing that I'm interested in grief, I'm wondering how you see your work having something to offer for someone who is grieving a loss of some kind in their lives.
Yeah. So the Book of the Bone Witch has prayers for grievers. And I think that it amplifies the idea that grief is really cyclical. So, you know, the idea that we move through these successive stages of grief and we check them off and then we're through it is wrong. That's not the way grief works. It comes back. Of course, the anniversary of the death, it comes back. And really, you know, to live in the world right now and be able to just scroll through traumas on your phone and see, you know, pictures of death just when you're in your kitchen.
Yeah.
Is so war. Strange. And war, yeah, it's strange to do that. Almost because there's no, or partly because there's no barrier. I mean, at least when you're choosing to turn on the news, you're pushing the button on the remote control on the TV, you know, you're making a choice to see that, you know, that you're probably not going to see anything amazing if you're turning on the news. But like your phone, you know, you might just be looking to see what your friend's having for lunch.
Yeah.
And then you have this terrible image in your, on your screen. So, so, you know, grief is ever present these days. And I think that one of the most potent messages around grief for me is that grief most of the time is gratitude. And of course, that's hard to hold that tension when you're in an acute stage of grief, because you're not quite there yet. But when you're in that cyclical grief, I think that knowing that grief is gratitude, we're grieving because we were grateful for having had that person in our life or that place in our life. Otherwise, we wouldn't be grieving now that they're absent. So I think that the prayers in the Book of the Bone Witch kind of amplify that idea that grief is gratitude and necessary and not something to run from. And and just ever present.
Excellent. Well, another quote you wrote, there are days when our world is a library full of books written by royals and their so-called holy men. But the greatest stories might be those that have been dismissed as tales for children. So I'm curious about what are some of your favorites and what kind of weight you give to like fairy tales and stuff not written by kings and holy men and royals. Like, tell me about your appreciation for what inspires you the most.
Yeah, I love that question. But it would have a very long answer if I was going to answer it comprehensively. So let me think. So fairy tales have historically been taken less seriously. And they are looked at as being children's stories. And so some of the prayers in Bones and Honey are these, what I call prayer stories, which are revisioned fairy tales. And for the most part, they're not revisioned completely. They are really left relatively intact from their original collected version. And while fairy tales were collected primarily by men, like the Brothers Grimm, they were transmitted primarily by women. And every fairy tale has a spell or a ritual or some piece of the old magic in it. Every single one, if you look, it's there. So I love this idea of the grandmother telling her grandchild this seemingly innocuous story that really has a spell in it, almost like it's a book of shadows. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be hunted or it wouldn't be burned because it's just a children's story. And of course, there are instances where fairy tales were outlawed, but for the most part, they were left to live. And so even now, like if I were to write a book that had fairy tale in the title, people would take that less seriously than if I'm going to write, you know, a heathen prayer book. And so I'm really attuned to that in my work. Like I can lead a workshop or a retreat or an immersion that can really be all about fairy tales, but I can't say fairy tale in the title necessarily, or people just aren't going to take it seriously. There's like that part, there's a little bit of a piece of us that I think becomes a child again when we see that that title of fairy tale.
Yeah.
And in a way that's important, and we need that because they really speak, these old stories speak to our innocence or the archetype of the inner innocent that lives in all of us. But on the other hand, it's not usually our inner child that's signing up for things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that especially fairy tales, I mean myth too and other types of folk tales, but especially fairy tales, they really are something special. And especially for people that, you know, maybe they don't identify as witches, but maybe they're witch curious.
Yeah.
There really is something to fairy tales as being kind of like an original book of shadows. And that's cool.
Yeah. You know, it's the middle of winter. Up here in Buffalo, we get pummeled by winter. I know that you're on the East Coast as well. This is not a place that has lovely times of this type of year. You know what I mean? I'm wondering if there's any like of the books that are really important to you that travel like seasonally. Like, does this book have any connections to the various, you know, seasons of the calendar?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it does. I, even though I didn't really name that in the book, because when I write, I almost have to organize my, when I'm writing a book specifically, I have to organize it according to the wheel of the year in my mind, just because that's such a primary lens for me that I almost need it to organize my thoughts. And so, like I said, I wrote this book primarily in winter, and yet I didn't want the entire book to appear or seem like it was written by my weeping snow hag, who's just always in these fallow places. I wanted to have, you know, the juiciness and the green moss and the warm sun in there also. But I did, I organized it, and I think it's pretty visible. Like the Book of the Bone Witch, for example, that we were talking about, that's very autumn, because that would be the season of letting go and watching nature, you know, befriend the fallowing. So that's the Book of the Bone Witch. And then there's some winter in there also. And then the Book of Wild Lovers, for example, I mean, that has really strong spring and summer energy and very lusty prayers there that wouldn't feel right in winter, you know, not in the same way anyway. So yes, it definitely is.
Very cool. You know, I'm wondering if there's any like activist messages that you feel like you're really trying to get across within some of your work. Like, what are you really hoping for people who encounter your work, like across any of your work? What are you hoping that they will pay attention to, like socially, environmentally, globally? Is there any like stuff that really you want to get across to your readers as being like an important thing that we should all be paying attention to?
Yeah, so many things. Probably most importantly, I think, is climate collapse. I mean, I know that there's a lot of really horrible atrocities going on in the realm of humanity specifically, but without the Earth, none of those things are really going to matter anymore. So I really feel like centering, you know, saving the planet and befriending really a new relationship between humanity and the beyond human, or the more than human, as they say, that that's really what we need to be doing right now. And I think that I go back and forth about this, but most of the time I believe that everyone that's alive right now, I mean, and I mean everyone, even the people that we may not want to be here at the same time as us, still everyone who is here kind of chose to be here for a particular reason. And that reason is to play a certain role in the dismantling of systems that need to crumble and the undoing of certain things. And of course, making room for the new and the healing to rise. But I hold this knowing my body. I'm an Aquarius, so I think this is an Aquarian thing, where I don't really feel like I'm going to see the end of this story. Like, I don't think that I'm going to be on my deathbed and be like, wow, the 2020s were wild. I'm so glad we came out of that.
Yeah.
I really think that in this incarnation, I'm here to see a lot unravel and maybe not necessarily see the new come to pass. I hope that my children or my grandchildren do, but I don't really feel like I get to. So, you know, I hold the tension of that. And I think that when we have that long vision, then we, of course, believe that the planet is sort of the central thing right now. But everybody's here to create their art and do what they need to do. But I do feel there's a grand design afoot.
Yeah. You know, Danielle, I have a random question. Whenever I think about like witchcraft and heathenry and just like kind of living on like the spiritual margins of like the US, I'm always wondering, I always think about you because of our conversations over the years. But something that I'm really wondering about is how you see what you do and what you care about, like depicted on things like TikTok and Instagram. And I'm wondering, if you have any opinions and thoughts on the way that like what you do as your practices in your life, how that's depicted to the wider world, and just any thoughts that stem from that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a good question. I am still largely unbothered by the way, you know, the witch aesthetic is presented on social media, or witch talk, as they say. I'm 44, so I'm not on TikTok. Mm-hmm. But I do see what my sons show me sometimes. And, you know, it's like when you're new to witchcraft, when you're a young witch, you're sort of learning from the places that you can learn from. And so for me in the 90s, that was really like the local witch stores or new age shops. I mean, they weren't local to me. I had to drive to get to them, but mm-hmm. it was asking the shop owner, you know, the person behind the counter, every question that I had, because we didn't really have, well, we didn't have the internet that I could Google things. And so I don't really know what it would have looked like for me if I did have those social media resources that a newer witch would have now. I can't say that I wouldn't have, you know, made those same strange reels about the spell that I was doing, or all of those things that I maybe as an older, more seasoned witch might disagree with, you know, objectively. But I don't necessarily, I don't think they're bad or that they're, you know, making witchcraft too, I don't know, accessible or palatable. I mean, talking about the medicinal archetypes that need to come through in this time of climate collapse, I really feel like the witch archetype is important. So all of those things on social media where we see the prevalence of the witch, I feel like that in the end is good. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really, it doesn't get to me usually.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. You know, I just mentioned a few minutes ago about, like, you and I are both in the U.S. The spiritual traditions of the United States over the past couple of centuries are probably pretty obvious to most listeners out there by now. And, you know, you've been now, like, writing and making these books for several years, and you're really engaged and entrenched in, like, the writing world and putting ideas out there for people to consider. And I'm wondering if you've heard from any readers about what kind of impact your work has had on them as far as like putting these kinds of ideas into the, you know, mainstream American society, that people can, like, you know, assess their pre-existing spiritual traditions, come to your work and kind of like see what kind of impact you've made on, you know, probably like people's lifelong practices. Like, have you heard from readers on how your work has like maybe changed their lives in a couple of ways?
Yeah. Most frequently I hear that about the Holy Wild. And I think for the most part, it is people who have, well, specifically women, since it's titled A Heathen Bible for the Untamed Woman, it's mostly women who read it. But I think they've already made the choice that they were going to make. So from the stories I've heard, sometimes that choice is, you know, leaving the relationship that wasn't good, or quitting the job that was killing them, or a lot of times it was leaving the church or making some sort of big decision about their spiritual path. But, you know, the book didn't make them make that choice. They had already made that choice. And then the book was, from what I've heard from people, was sort of like the salve that they needed, or the permission slip that they didn't know they needed, but the choice had already been made. But it was sort of a way of making it make sense. Mm-hmm. The choice that they made. Yeah. I still get those messages. Excellent. Even though that book came out a while ago.
Well, Danielle, what are your plans next? Bones and Honey's out. The Holy Wild Grimoire is out. These are very recent books that people can find that are still basically brand new texts. Like, you're prolific writing nature is just so impressive to me. I was like, whenever your publicist Kim told me that the Holy Wild Grimoire had come out in between our last cycle and Finding Bones and Honey, I was like, oh my gosh, Danielle is writing like crazy. I'm wondering what you're working on next. And if you have any plans that you're looking at for the next, like, you know, 2 to 5 years, what you got coming up in the pipeline?
Ooh, 2 to 5 years. Wow. I tend to not think that far ahead.
Gotcha.
I am writing
that timeline.
Don't know who I'll be in 5 years. Yeah. But I am writing a new book that I do think this one will take a bit longer. I don't expect that this one is going to be written in a couple of months like Bones and Honey was, but it's about this kind of fairy tale psychology specific to the witch's psyche and about how those spells are really housed in every single old fairy tale and kind of finding that and honing it and seeing how it's incredibly transformative looking at it through that lens. So as far as writing goes, that's where my mind is right now, but I am on the verge of this incredible transition. So I don't really know exactly what my life is going to look like even a year from now. Mm-hmm. It's going to look very, very different. But I'm hoping just, you know, so much like slower and better and more simple, but
wonderful.
Yeah, I'm looking to be the witch on the fringes in the old stories. I've been very much in the center of things. I'm looking to kind of move to the outskirts or the borderlands a little bit more.
I love it. Well, Danielle Dulski, your new book, Bones and Honey, a heathen prayer book, but also the Holy Wild Grimoire, a heathen handbook of magic spells and verses, among other books that we've chatted about on this podcast over the years, all out from New World Library. I'm delighted to reconnect and catch up after a 4-year gap between our last conversation. Thank you so much for your time and energy and stories and hanging out with me. It means a lot. Thank you so much for being here once again.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me back, Greg.